This is the Y2K edition of Functional Medicine Update, January 2000, Volume 19, Number 1. In this milepost issue of FMU, we present an overview of the past, present, and future of functional medicine. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update. Yes, it's the new millennium, January, year 2000. I hope you got through Y2K, and I hope you're with us with all the lights and power and water running, and we're really pleased to be with you here, the year 2000 issue, and I think you'll find this to be one of the most auspicious and unique of our now going on 19 years of doing Functional Medicine Update. We're in our 18th year now, and we'll be heading on in June to our 19th anniversary, so it's with a lot of real pride that I look back over the past 18 years of visiting with clinical practitioners and researchers around the world, and it's with no small amount of sense of respect that I have for how this field has evolved and who has been its principal contributors and how it is shaping for this new millennium a healthcare system that is vastly different from that which was present at the start of what was then called Metabolic Update, later to be called Preventive Medicine Update, and now more recently, Functional Medicine Update. I'm reminded as to what we would really like to get out of a year 2000, centennial millennium edition. I mean, it's almost too much of a threat to even think that we could adequately do justice to the last millennium or the last century or even the last decade with regard to what's happened in the field of biomedical sciences and health delivery and the extraordinary number of people that have made these contributions to its evolution. But being undaunted as we are, I've decided that we'll move ahead and give it a whirl anyway, and we will dedicate this issue, our Millennium Edition, to those people who have really made the most principal contributions to the evolution of this field, at least as I have seen it from my very myopic and sometimes limited perspective. What I would like to do is give attribution and kind of through the eyes and the work of these men and women who have made their contributions, see how this field is putting itself together. And therefore, the theme of this month's Functional Medicine Update is past, present, and future, back to the future in functional medicine. There's no place better to start than to start at the turn of the century and talk about two individuals who have really made contributions that I think have been dominant themes within Functional Medicine Update education over this last 18 years. The first is Dr. Archibald Garrod, and I'm really reminded of the extraordinary article that was written by Dr. Garrod, authored by him in 1902 in the Lancet Medical Magazine. Dr. Garrod was the father of discovery of the first genetic metabolism diseases. He looked at diseases of infancy that were tied to the genetics that had metabolic consequences and started down the road of attempting to have us understand early in the 20th century where the origin of many diseases might have come from the soil of the genes, and how the genes then were exposed to certain kinds of things in the environment that ultimately led to these disorders. And he was a discoverer of alkaptonuria, and from that we had phenylketonuria and these other diseases that were found to be genetic metabolism diseases of infancy, many of which were nutritionally modifiable, like we saw with methylmalonic aciduria, later discovered in the early 20th century, where vitamin B12 could be used to prevent the retardation of infancy and help individuals live reasonably normal lives by just increasing their vitamin B12 intake some 100 times the recommended dietary allowance for most people, than in these genetically unique individuals, 100 times the level of intake would be that required for their function. So what did Dr. Garrod tell us in 1902? And there's an interesting quote from his article. It says, "It might be claimed that what used to be spoken of as a diathesis of a disease is nothing else but chemical individuality. It is nearly true to say the factors which confer upon us our predisposition and immunities from disease are inherent in our very chemical structure, and even in the molecular groupings from which went to the making of the chromosomes from which we sprang." And I want you to recall, 1902, that modern concept, it was some 53 years before Watson and Crick published their landmark article on the structure of the chromosomes and DNA in the chromosomes, the biological basis of inheritance. And yet, Archibald Garrod had the prescience to look ahead and see where medicine was going to be going in the next 100 years, and it's now at this turn of the century, in this new millennium transformation, the concept of molecular medicine is just weaving its way very seriously into the future of how doctors will treat their patients. So I would certainly start our past, present, and future discussion with Archibald Garrod, and I would go on from there, obviously, to talk about his very close colleague, intellectual lineage, Dr. Linus Pauling, who a period not too much after, in the early 1900s, from a period of about 1930 to 1950, made extraordinary contributions in how we view the origin of disease. And his first article that really, I think, did a marvelous job in helping us to understand this was the article on sickle cell anemia. Sickle cell anemia really got us to recognize that there was something about the genes that could contribute to a disorder that could cut across many organ systems and produce symptoms at a distance that were much more complicated and much more diffuse than we had originally thought when we thought of a vector disease model, the Pasteurian model, the model that says you get a disease as a consequence of an infectious organism that then creates a specific, very well-defined set of symptoms for which if you get over it and have your remission from the symptoms, that you're beyond the disease. The molecular medicine model was very different of Pauling because what it indicated was that in sickle cell anemia, which is the first disease that he discovered its origin at the molecular level, he found that the single point gene mutation on the heavy chain of the globin molecule of hemoglobin could contribute then to a conformational change in the way that the hemoglobin molecule structured in three dimensions. And that conformational change had a difference then in how oxygen bound to the heme portion of the hemoglobin molecule, thereby creating then a different kind of relationship between the molecule and its oxygen absorption-desorption phenomena. And that molecule shape change, because it then changed the shape of the red cell, because about three-quarters of the volume of a red cell is occupied by hemoglobin, the shape change of the molecule, which led to packing of these funny-shaped hemoglobins, the sickle hemoglobins, resulted then in an actual shape change of the normal bidiscoid red cell to become like a sickle, looking like something you would harvest the wheat with, and this sickle would cut its way through the vasculature. And the sickling shape change was a consequence of the geometric change of the molecule hemoglobin caused by one single amino acid within a chain of hundreds of amino acids that would cause this molecule to become more hydrophobic, meaning to crystallize with itself, to pack with itself, which then caused the molecule to form these crystalline bodies within the red cell, which was associated then with sickle cell anemia. What Pauling predicted back in this landmark article in Science magazine with his postdoctoral medical student Charles Itano, he predicted that this molecular origin of disease would be found to have extraordinary implications because as we learn more about the origin of these diseases, ultimately we would find a way to modify the expression and function of these genes in such a way as to prevent the expression of the disease. That was the model that was published in 1949. I think that's a powerful concept. And as you know, in 1992, in the New England Journal of Medicine, a paper was published showing that by the administration of sodium butyrate intravenously to patients who have sickle cell characteristic, that you could prevent the hemoglobinopathies associated with the genetic disorder. Why did beta butyrate, sodium butyrate, have that effect? Sodium butyrate had that effect because butyrate alters the gene expression and creates then an upregulation of the expression of fetal hemoglobin. Fetal hemoglobin is not sickled, and therefore when fetal hemoglobin diluted the sickled hemoglobin in the red cell, it prevented the sickled hemoglobins from packing together, from hydrophobic interactions and crystallizing, and as such, the shape of the cell did not change and it did not cause the damage across the organs that we relate to sickle crisis. So here was some 40 years after Pauling proposed this model, was the proof of the pudding, was the clinical outcome of that model that has now started us to think that maybe there would be agents that could modify gene expression in such a way as to create a different phenotype, an outcome not of disease and premature illness, but an outcome of rectangularizing survival and producing high-level living for many decades, if we just ask the right questions about the genes and can modify their expression and function. A very profound concept born out of the Archibald Garrod discoveries of molecular illness at the turn of the century. So Linus Pauling would certainly rank up in our priority ranking of an individual, he and his wife, Eva Helen, that told us about structure and function, about complementarity, about the concepts of fit, about the concepts of communication. And you can communicate at the atomic level, the molecular level, the supermolecular level, at the tissue level, at the organ level, organ system level, whole organism, individuals, families, societies, nations, planet. There can be communication at all these levels through complementary natures of relationships, being good listeners and good transmitters and being on the same wavelength, so to speak. And that's a model of medicine that is now starting to unfold as we move into this 21st century, the model that we have transmitting messages and we have receiving messages. Transmitters are the molecules that we call the mediators, and the receivers are the membrane receptor binding sites and the soluble receptor sites that in fact pick up the messages and translate it into altered gene expression and altered function, and that we can manipulate those both messages and their reception on the basis of what? The things that we do every day by how we think, act, eat, feel, where we live, the nature of our relationship, how our environment influences, the nature of our own spiritual belief systems can influence these mediating molecules, and how, as Dr. Candace Pert has talked about, can lead to a informational rubric within the new expanding health paradigm. Informational rubric, communicating the right messages, receiving the right messages to be in synchrony with our genes to give rise to function. Now that might appear esoteric to many of you, but if you've been following Functional Medicine Update for the last 2 years, you know that has been an underlying theme that we see as probably the transformational theme in healthcare sciences moving into the new millennium, is the concept of modifying how genes express their phenotype to create a different message and how they interrelate that message to the outside and inside environment. So we certainly owe both Dr. Gerard and Dr. Pauling a lot of attribution for helping us down that road. A third person that we would certainly put on that list is Dr. Roger Williams. Dr. Roger Williams, his work in the late 40s, early 50s, into the 60s, was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, if you think of a biochemist who was at the top of his game, he was the president of the American Chemical Society, he was the discoverer of a number of the B-complex vitamins, including pantothenic acid, and you think of this person who, by all rights, would be locked into the myopic vision of a pure scientist looking at molecular structures and biochemical function, yet his work on biochemical individuality, published as such as a book and now reprinted in the 1990s, because it's such a classic text, got us to think about biological diversity beyond that of just the difference in hair color, eye color, skin color, which there are very few differences in phenotypes really among the human population relative to the wide-ranging difference that Dr. Williams brought to our attention at the anatomy and physiological level and at the biochemical level, where the range of function was far greater than we might have guessed just on the basis of the numbers of differences in our physiognomy, our hair, eye, or skin color. The book that Dr. Roger Williams authored that was published in the late 70s, entitled Nutrition Against Disease, was a major, major contribution to the field, and one that really created my modified thinking program and pattern, and changed the way that the research was done in my laboratories as a professor in biochemistry. That the Roger Williams work, Nutrition Against Disease, got us thinking about the role that various nutrients play in preventing what he called genetotrophic diseases. Genetotrophic diseases, what are those? Those are diseases for which there are genetic uniquenesses for specific needs of nutrients beyond that of which the average Gaussian curve midline individual might require in order to promote optimal function and prevent premature disease. And what did he say that those diseases would be? He called them the major chronic degenerative diseases of aging, the diseases of heart disease and cancer and diabetes and arthritis. He thought that those would be related to genetotrophic imperfections, where the genes called for a different level of nutrition and lifestyle that were not delivered by that person's selection, that then obviated itself or observed itself over the course of living 4, 5, 6, 7 decades as degenerative disease, quote, of unknown origin, end quote. He called these genetotrophic diseases. He even included diseases of mental illness into that category, and childhood diseases, behavior disorders, and alcoholism, he felt were all interrelated to this mismatch of genes and environment, that the person was asking at their genetic level for different levels of nutrients to promote proper phenotypic function, for which if it was not received in their need, would lead to the undernutrition that is seen as chronic disease in midlife. A very powerful concept that revolutionized our thinking about the origin of age-related diseases. Not just the Pasteurian vector disease model, not just the model of injury, but the model of matching the uniqueness of that person to their diet and lifestyle to promote optimal function. It bears obvious resemblance to that of Dr. Archibald Garrod's concept, but it takes it to the next level, the genetotrophic disease concept. And it marries itself very nicely to Dr. Pauling's concept of orthomolecular medicine, using substances that are natural to human physiology for modifying function or normalizing function, orthomolecular medicine. And as you recall, Dr. Pauling had a landmark paper in the Science magazine that really revolutionized thinking in all of medicine called Orthomolecular Psychiatry, 1967 that paper was published. And in that, he actually lays out the model as to how nutrients taken at much higher doses than that of the recommended dietary allowances can promote improved function in people that have these metabolic uniquenesses, these biochemical individual characteristics. What he pointed out is that Le Chatelier's principle comes to play. Le Chatelier, the French chemist aristocrat that was beheaded during the French Revolution, said that if you have an equilibrium and apply a stress to an equilibrium, the equilibrium will move in the direction to minimize the stress. It's interesting. I think Le Chatelier should have listened to his own principle. Maybe he wouldn't have been beheaded, but that's a social commentary. And talking from a chemical perspective, what Dr. Pauling pointed out was that if you have a genetically imperfect enzyme and you want to promote its function to unblock a metabolic block, one of the ways you can do that, if there is a coenzymic imperfection, coenzymes come basically from nutrients like the B vitamins or minerals, that you then increase the level of that specific coenzyme to try to drive that sloppy equilibrium or that sluggish equilibrium to completion. I always thought of this like a baseball glove analogy. You know, those of you that might have had baseball gloves when you were a youngster, you recall you really valued having a good pocket in your glove so that if the ball came even close to your glove, it would stick in that pocket. And I recall as a little leaguer taking my new glove and putting oil on it and then putting the ball in there and sleeping on it under my mattress for a week so I'd really get a good pocket. Well, that would be like an enzyme that's very tightly bound to its coenzyme and can produce then an active form of the enzyme that catches the balls every time they hit to you. If, however, you have a glove that's been warped and the pocket isn't quite right, no matter how much you sleep on it, it still doesn't bind the ball very well, then you can miss a lot of balls. You're hit a lot of balls. Eventually, some are going to stick in your glove, but you might have to have a lot of more balls hit at you before you're going to have one catch. This is the kinetic molecular theory related to metabolic function. And so what Pauling said is, by increasing the frequency of hit of the ball against the glove, i.e. the apoenzyme against the enzyme, it increases then the probability that you will get an active enzyme that then can participate in metabolic function. And this wasn't just built around idle speculation. He, in this article, pointed out binding constants and transference rates and KMs of enzymes that were having different genetic states of control of their velocity of a reaction, and showed that by increasing the concentration of the coenzyme, i.e. the vitamin or mineral, he was able to demonstrate improved velocity of substrate going to product. Well, that's a very lot of biochemical polysyllabic stuff that really speaks to the underlying rationalization as to why nutrient for one may be different than that for another, and in some cases of genetic uniqueness may be vastly different. As Roger Williams said in a talk that I heard him present 20 years ago, when asked how he could support this concept of biochemical individuality in his sage, very wise way, he turned and he said, "Nutrition is for real people. Statistical humans are of little interest." And everybody in the audience recognized they had spent a lot of years in school studying statistical humans, never to see one of them when they got out into real practice, because people are uniquely different. They are facets on the diamond of life. They have different characteristics. And as a consequence, we need to be treating real people with the respect of their biochemical uniqueness. So that was the Roger Williams contribution. And then, of course, in the same period of the 1950s, what a rich period, we also had Dr. Abram Hoffer. Dr. Abram Hoffer, who helped us as a PhD in chemistry and an MD in psychiatry, to recognize that the molecular milieu of the brain could in fact influence outcome of function. He and Humphrey Osmond, working together, produced an extraordinary concept, the Humphrey Osmond Abram Hoffer precept, that schizophrenia and other types of mental illness may be associated in certain people with brain chemistry defects that are modifiable, again, by changing the molecular milieu of the brain. This is where they showed that vitamin B3 or nicotinic acid or pyridoxine, vitamin B6, and ascorbic acid, vitamin C, when given together or singularly in high doses to certain individuals with schizophreniform disorders, that they would have clearance of their mental illness. And I recall myself in the car traveling to a medical meeting back in the 70s with a very esteemed medical school professor who had become a clinical psychiatrist and was very strongly supporting Dr. Hoffer's work, you know, at some risk to his own career, I might add, because it wasn't considered politic back in the 70s to talk about vitamins and mental health. And I asked him in the flow of the conversation as we were traveling to the meeting how it was that he himself might have taken on this what appeared to be an adversarial position with his colleagues about the role that vitamins could play in therapeutic doses in treating certain forms of mental illness. And his response is, I want you to recall that I, as a fairly capable professional in this field, found myself having a schizophreniform attack in a mental hospital for observation. And once I got in there, I found that I couldn't get out because they basically said, well, no, I think you need to be here for watchful therapy. And they were trying to give me the various drugs that I had prescribed myself. And I knew their side effects and knew their implications. I said, no, you're not going to give those to me. And so we had this battle back and forth. And finally, my wife smuggled into me vitamin B6 and vitamin B3. And I took those in high dose. And over the course of the next month had a complete remission and have remained in remission. And as I've had my plasma and urine studied over the years, I found out that, lo and behold, I had these metabolites in my urine that are associated with brain disturbances that are resolvable with high-dose B6 and B3. So I became a believer. I became a complete devotee of this principle, and I've dedicated my life as a professional to that field. Well, it's these personal observations that have often driven many people or attracted many people or stimulated or given permission for many people to come into this field. Often it wasn't through their training because their training told them something differently. Eat a diet of moderation and variety. Don't worry about any high doses of vitamins because if you don't have scurvy, beriberi, pellagra, xerothalmia, rickets, you don't have to worry about it. And in fact, to take high doses of nutrients at least produces expensive urine and at most might produce toxicity. Have you ever heard any of those particular rationale being communicated? And the answer is yes. If you've been in this field or even been a listener to societal exchange, you certainly recognize that's been a dominant theme that has tried to dissuade individuals from considering how nutrients might modify function at doses far greater than that of the recommended dietary allowances and beyond variety and moderation built around biochemical uniqueness. So again, Abraham Hoffer and Humphrey Osmond with their extraordinary work on schizophrenia and Dr. Hoffer's understanding of organic chemistry and biochemistry helped to revolutionize that of the field of psychiatry. So three people in the 50s really have created an impetus of change that we see as we move into the new millennium. Dr. Linus Pauling, Dr. Roger Williams, Dr. Abraham Hoffer. Let's not forget, during that same period moving into the 60s, another extraordinary contributor, a person who by all stretch of imagination deserves and certainly deserved in his own lifetime a Nobel Prize in medicine, but for reasons that are still beyond the scope of understanding did not receive it. And that's Hans Selye, the father of the word stress taken from physics to apply to physiology, one of the most commonly used terms in our late 20th century, moving into 21st century living, picosecond, time-compressed, time-urgent society in which stress is almost the watchword of being a successful survivor of this generation. Selye is the gentleman who did the work on adrenalectomized animals, and by a series of very remarkable coincidences, if there are such things, he was able to make this connection between the adrenal glands and stress and physiological function in these animals. And although he was reputed to be a very poor experimentalist, he was obviously a very bright observer and a very wise person as it relates to taking these observations and putting together a theme that really creates a tremendous cornerstone of the way medicine will be practiced in the 21st century, and that is the endocrine environmental interrelationship on how our nociceptor and proprioceptor systems respond to our environment through perceptions of stress or distress, this hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, the antennae of our body that are out there sampling the energy of our world to see if it's energy that's in coincidence with our body called harmonic friendly energy or dysfunctional energy that's outside the range of harmonic coordinated function that we call dis-energy or distress. Selye, with his model of stress, I think, opened up through his general adaptation syndrome, GAS. And remember what the GAS goes through. It goes through three stages. Arousal, where the adrenal glands are stimulated to action, like a zebra trying to get away from a lion. That would be certainly a period of arousal, and the adrenal glands are pouring out cortisol, and you're having an adrenaline reaction upon the metabolic pathways. This is what Dr. Sapolsky, Robert Sapolsky, talks about in his book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. a wonderful stress physiologist at Stanford University Medical School that has helped us to better understand the physiology of stress and how hypercortisolemia over long periods of time can lead to more rapid brain aging. That's Dr. Sapolsky's concepts that have come out of his research. And what we found from the work of Dr. Cellier was that this stress response first goes through arousal, then it goes through adaptation, where the person says, well, I'm not under stress, everything's fine, but their adrenal glands are now still hypertrophied and they're getting different physiological function, different messenger molecules, they're living in a state of hyperadrenaline and hypercortisol, and then finally, if they push too hard, the pedal goes to the metal too long and too intensely, then we get what was, as a child I recall, called a nervous breakdown. He called it exhaustion, adrenal exhaustion. So it goes through arousal, adaptation, and exhaustion. That's the general adaptation syndrome. One might say that in our culture, this GAS, that people are running out of gas. That's one of the problems we have in our physiological response to our lifestyle is that we're running out of gas, the general adaptation syndrome. So again, I think we would say Dr. Cellier helped us significantly to understand how environments in our life and our perception of those environments through our sensory perception systems can be translated into physiological function. And of course, that gave birth in the later part of the century to the work that people like Candace Pert have done in finding on the surface of white cells membrane binding sites for these neuropeptides, the substances secreted by our nervous system in response to perceptions of how our environment is influencing us. So we now see that the immune system is a brain and the brain is the immune system. We have this traveling immune system and this traveling brain that are going through our cells as the mediators that come from our nervous system communicate with the immune system, and as the immune system then signals through its release of mediators that are called cytokines and chemokines, messages that are transcommunicated to and received by the nervous system. So it's a web of physiological understanding that's emerged over the last 30 or 40 years, not just a digital compartmentalized analytic group of separate organs that we study kind of in as chapters in a textbook that we then take a test on the end of that chapter and say, all is fine, I understand that, and then we go on to the next chapter as if that organ was somehow separated from the other organ. They are all part of one. It's a holographic system. That's one of the fundamental underpinnings of functional medicine, is that in every organ you can see any other organ. And therefore, this holography, the brain is a gut, the gut is a brain, the immune system is the liver is a brain. There are all these interrelated communications. And to better understand dysfunction, we have to understand function at this level of web-like interaction. So we owe Dr. Cellier tremendous respect and admiration for those contributions. And then we go to Dr. Emmanuel Sharaskin. Very interesting background, a medical doctor and also a dentist by training, University of Alabama, Birmingham professor, and was one of the first people to really do controlled studies on the influence of nutrition on function. And I really want to give Dr. Sharaskin a tremendous attribution, having known him for many years and really used his presentations as a model for what I wanted to do as an educator. I think he made extraordinary contributions. His book, Prospective Medicine, was at least 20 years ahead of its time. A prolific author, a good investigator, an excellent communicator, a very polished speaker, Dr. Sharaskin helped us to understand that function is more than just the absence of disease, that there is something about function that can be promoted through lifestyle and nutrition, that if we ask the right questions, we get different answers. And he helped us to really ask those different questions about function. And we owe Dr. Sharaskin, I think, a tremendous debt of gratitude. It's interesting to note, I recall speaking to him later in his professional career, and he had said that he had written something like 14 books for the health professional, none of which were well received and widely used because they advanced this precept that was not considered in the standard norm of its time, and that is that there is something more than the absence of disease that we call health, and it just wasn't a theme that medicine nor dentistry was ready to accept. But he wrote one book for the general public, and it was a bestseller. And he said maybe the best way to take a message is not to try to take it to the sclerosed brains of the health professionals, but to take it to the general public that's much more receptive for change and for factual information. I don't want to make a decision or a discussion or an implication about sclerosed brains, but I would prefer to say that I think we're seeing, as we move into the new millennium, a great transformation in the thinking of healthcare providers about how they can better serve their patients, how they can be more effective in their jobs, how they can get away from becoming pill counters and prescription writers and into a true healing system. And it is that transformation that Dr. Raskin really contributed to helping us think about. During the same period of time, which is the 60s and moving into the 70s, there are several other people who influenced this field tremendously. First of all, Dr. Cleave wrote an extraordinary book that I think is one of the landmarks called The Saccharine Diseases. And in this book, Dr. Cleave pointed out from Britain that when cultures underwent the transformation from their whole unrefined products into their white products, the products of processing, this would be white sugar, white flour, and white fat, that a whole new array of diseases started to develop, and it was uniform and reproducible in the world no matter where you look. He called these the saccharine diseases, diabetes and heart disease and cancer and hypertensive relationships to stroke. I think that, again, from a very well-respected scientist who was very esteemed in the British medical community, for him to talk about the saccharine diseases as a serious part of medicine, again, opened up the door for us to start looking differently at the origin of disease. Of course, there were several other people that were of his same genre and same period that helped guide that same thought. Next was the work by Dr. John Yudkin that was popularized in a book that he authored called Sweet and Dangerous, which I think got us to think about white sugar, the increasing effect of the magnitude of white sugar that was coming into the diet as what are called hidden sugars, not sugar you take out of the bottle or the sugar dispenser, but rather hidden sugars in foods and beverages that continually increased our simple carbohydrate exposure and created an altered metabolic function in these individuals. This was a very profound change in thinking, where in the past it was thought that carbohydrate was carbohydrate and there's no big deal. And those people that were talking about sugar being dangerous were just kind of the artifactual weirdos in the health food fields, and they had no scientific understanding of the effect, and therefore it was all an exaggeration. That was not true, said Dr. Yudkin, that there was a basis for this concern built around carbohydrate sensitivity of individuals who had simple carbohydrate sensitivity. Of course, during this period, a third individual that we would give a lot of attribution to, whose name I think stands tall in the hallows of this health transformation, was Dr. Dennis Burkett. Dr. Burkett was a public health physician working in South Africa for many years, a tremendous investigator, and I have a suspicion a very, very high-quality doctor. He and I were roommates, actually, in a medical meeting now 22 years ago that really changed my whole thinking, because Dr. Burkett, as you know, was not only the discoverer of Burkitt's lymphoma and did a lot of epidemiological work around a virus-induced cancer, Burkitt's lymphoma, but he was the person who really studied seriously the dietary fiber connection to health and disease. He recorded very, very fastidiously the fecal remnants of individuals eating wild-type diets in Africa and those that were then on the transition white diet, the saccharine-type diets that Dr. Cleave talked about, and these were the white flour, white sugar-rich diets, and showed that there was a very close correlation between the bulk and the diet called roughage, which I recall as a child, roughage was considered like a bad term. You know, it's like, why would you want roughage? Cows eat roughage, not humans. But he showed that this concept of fiber had a tremendous impact not only on digestive diseases like hernia and diverticular disease and the relationship to appendicitis, but it also had a very significant effect on risk to other systemic diseases like cardiovascular disease. Low-fiber diets increased risk to cardiovascular disease. This was the observation that Dr. Burkett made and was the first to publish this in serious medical literature and really, again, got us thinking in a much broader way about the natural diet versus a highly purified diet, that space food sticks, which were the rage in the 50s, were maybe not the best way to live in terms of complete nutrition, that we need these things that are in whole food diets that we've evolved with through our Paleolithic ancestor and on to create then improved function. And in fact, as you recall, Dr. Mel Koner and Boyd Eaton wrote this extraordinary article in the late 1980s in the New England Journal of Medicine called Paleolithic Nutrition, in which they actually talked about the anthropological work that had been done on diet and health over the period of our Paleolithic ancestors and indicated that our diets were a balance of vegetable and animal products because we used a grasping thumb as a gathering animal and we weren't that good as a hunter because we didn't have telescopic sights and high-powered rifles, so we'd have to find younger, diseased, or old animals to try to catch them. But our grasping thumb would allow us to pick and gather things, and as a consequence, we had a lot of vegetable products in its unrefined state, and we ate some degree of lean muscle meats, and these animals, we ate the whole animal, including the bone marrow, which gave us calcium, and when we did that, we had a very high EPA content, essential fatty acids from the omega-3 family, because those animals foraged on natural vegetables, which were rich in omega-3, cold weather, vegetable oils, And as such, the meat we had in those days really had a high level of omega-3 versus the meat that we eat today that's very rich in omega-6 linoleic acids and arachidonic acid because the animals are fed corn, which is a warm weather plant. And as a consequence, we have changed the whole way that we eat today, both in composition and quantity. That was the Eaton and Connor interesting paper in the New England Journal of Medicine on Paleolithic nutrition, and it follows very closely together with what Dennis Burkett and Yudkin and Cleave were talking to us about unrefined diets and how in populations that continue to eat this diet of less refined nature that they had much lower incidences of various types of Western diseases. This is a major, major change in our thinking, and it's one that has dominated the now last four decades in the evolution of a healthcare paradigm as we go into the new millennium, in which diet will be seen more as a way of improving function and getting the most out of our genes. And it will become a primary tool in health promotion and disease prevention and even therapeutics. It's interesting as we look at this whole history to recognize it was only three or four decades ago where nutrition was taught almost exclusively in land-grant colleges in the Department of Home Economics and Food and Dietetics. And where was that set? That was set in an ag school. People that went on to the university to become medical doctors didn't get that training because that was kind of woman's work. It was in those laboratories called the food labs where women sat in there and learned how to bake cakes and make brownies. That was the perception. There was virtually no value that if you're going to go on to a male-centered medical school training in the university, that was where all the action was. And you didn't want to be bothered with this other nutrition stuff because that was obviously not very high-tech and not good science. Now we are seeing, coming back to full circle, to recognize that the most powerful ways that our genes are manipulated through the course of living to their phenotypic function is through how we eat, think, act, and believe, much more than the medicines we take or the surgeries we have had provided. Those are rescue approaches to the symphony of communication between our diet and our genes, giving rise to the expression of function, of which the micronutrients, the macronutrients, and the conditionally essential nutrients in our diet play continuous roles in washing over our genes to give rise to their function. A very, very interesting thing that, again, was born out of these observations by people like Dr. Cleave, Dr. Yudkin, and Dr. Burkett. And what about vitamins and their particular role in therapeutic applications? Are there any early-stage investigators that we could trace back these concepts? And I think we'd have to go back to Dr. Fred Klinner, who, as you recall, during the polio era of the 30s and 40s, started making observations, this is before the Sabin and Salk vaccines, by administering high doses of intravenous vitamin C to patients who had polio, that he observed that there could be considerable improvement in their function and remission of the neuropathology of polio. Although this was considered very, very heretical to good thought, Dr. Klinner was extraordinarily committed to this concept, wrote on it, spoke on it, did not receive a lot of medical support on his concepts, but talked about vitamin C as a virucidal agent to help in the treatment of and management of polio infection. Following this was also Dr. Erwin Stone, who some of you know had done a tremendous job in understanding the vitamin C connection to physiology by tracing back its genetic history, showing that our ancestors, not too many millions of years ago, had the ability to manufacture their own vitamin C through an enzyme called L-glucanolactone oxidase, an enzyme that converts glucose through glucose 6-phosphate ultimately into vitamin C. And we're one of the few animals that lost that enzyme activity. There are a few birds and fruit-eating bats and the guinea pig that have lost that as well. But most all other animals, including the goat, can make their own vitamin C. And in fact, as Dr. Pauling pointed out, and this is actually coming from conversations he had with Dr. Stone, the goat, which weighs about the same as a human, will make each day somewhere around a couple hundred milligrams of vitamin C in its own adrenal glands through this L-glucanolactone oxidase biochemical process. But when the goat is under stress, it will make 1,000 or more milligrams of vitamin C. Because we do not have, as Dr. Stone pointed out, the ability to upregulate vitamin C synthesis during stress, because it's a vitamin for us, a life-giving vitamine. Actually, it's not an amine, so in this case it's a carbohydrate remnant, but it still has the ability to prevent a disease called scurvy, which is its deficiency disease. That vitamin C is important in function for more than just the prevention of scurvy. And Dr. Stone pointed out it is a stress vitamin. It is manufactured in all other animals at higher doses during stress, for which it cannot be made in higher quantities in humans during stress, and therefore it becomes increasingly important during times of stress. And yet the RDAs that were said at the time were a dose that was adequate to meet the needs of practically all healthy people to prevent scurvy with a margin of error. And therefore, it was a 30 milligram dose RDA, which we said was more than enough because you could prevent scurvy in most people at 10 milligrams a day. So there was a margin of error in the RDA over the MDR, the minimum daily requirements. Well, think if you would about, is there a difference between prevention of a deficiency disease and optimization of physiological function of the some 100 or so different biochemical reactions that depend upon vitamin C and its related dehydroascorbate for their function. And of course, Dr. Stone's concept was, if you really look at animal studies very carefully, those animals that make vitamin C, you'll find that the requirement they have to promote function for vitamin C under different physiological or chemical stresses is much higher than that which they can get readily in their diet. And therefore, there can be needs of a conditional essential supplementation, not to mention even biochemical diversity, that is the biochemical uniqueness discussed by Dr. Roger Williams. So I think that's a very interesting point that Dr. Stone, which then influenced Dr. Linus Pauling considerably. I mean, it's unfortunate that Dr. Pauling in the later years of his career got dubbed by some people very, I think, inappropriately as the vitamin C guru. Certainly he had a lot to say about vitamin C and helped to raise the understanding of vitamins and their relationship to health and health promotion to a much higher degree than before. But Dr. Pauling was much more than just the vitamin C guru. His use of vitamin C was built around this whole model of biochemical individuality and matching the need for the physiological condition of the individual. By the way, you might say, are there any cultural supports for this discussion that you're having? And of course, you know, those of you who have been following this field, that two very primary investigators, observers, professionals who made these observations around the turn of the century up into the 30s and early 40s were Dr. Weston Price and his wife, a dentist from Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Price and his wife had the fortune of traveling around the world at a time that much of the world was starting to become industrialized or westernized. So they were undergoing a transformation from the cultural habits that they may have had for centuries to a new lifestyle habit. And they did have access to something no one else had, which was the camera. So they could record the observations that they made in these places they traveled around the world, to Eskimo villages and to landlocked valleys in Switzerland, to Africa, to Aboriginals in Australia. And by coming back repetitively to these same places in the world and seeing these people grow up over 15 or 20 or 30 years and recording on photographs how they had changed, they saw what they considered to be the physical degeneration of these people as their diets went to the saccharine-type diets, the white flour, white sugar, alcohol, fat-rich diets. And no matter where the culture was, no matter what their previous diet had been, if they started transitioning to this highly refined diet, their conclusion was that the bones of the face changed shape, that the jaw changed shape, the teeth started to become crowded, the nose flattened, and the nasopharynx changed, so they got rhinitis and sinusitis, they became more allergic, their vitality just went down. It wasn't their genes changed, it was the expression of the genes into their phenotype as a consequence of the altered diet, said Dr. Price. Well, during the same period was Bob Pottinger. Some of you know he was working in tuberculosis clinics in Southern California, and was trying to develop ways of treating the TB of the time, and was using in the sanitarium adrenal extracts, and started to look, therefore, had a whole compound, an animal compound, and look at these animals that had been adrenalectomized and animals related to the diets, trying to keep these animals alive and healthy. It was his observation that when he moved these animals because of the war and the deficiency of certain kinds of animal food products, he moved them to a cooked milk, cooked meat diet, that the health of the animals just deteriorated very, very rapidly. And then he started doing inbreeding studies and showing that, lo and behold, by the third generation of these cats that had been fed the cooked meat, cooked milk diet, that they basically weren't able to have live birth, that the fourth generation just was not making it. They had so much fertility difficulties and developmental difficulties. In fact, at the third generation, he produced which is what I've been told is the first allergic cat in the veterinary literature. And this was a cat that had unbelievable sinusitis, rhinitis, and all the autoimmune disease that we might associate with asthma. Maybe not autoimmune, that's the wrong word, but an inflammatory, histamine-driven and cytokine-driven phenomena called asthma seemed to be present in this third-generation cat fed the cooked meat, cooked milk diet. He then went on and did many very, very good studies, had over 3,100, as I recall, plates in animals in which they fed the raw meat and cooked milk, raw meat and raw milk, cooked meat and raw milk, and cooked meat and cooked milk, and looked at the effects then on the animals in breeding experiments, and then also examined some very interesting things about the soil, their urine, looked at their urine analysis, and made some observations that as the diet became more highly processed and something was lost in the food by processing and over-treating, that the vitality of the animals went way down. Again, this is in the early stage of understanding the implication of the full complement of food on function. It's interesting that Dr. Lucille Hurley at the University of California, Davis, later came back to look at zinc nutriture in animals and showing by the third generation in baboons of zinc deprivation that she could produce animals whose immunological function was so compromised that they were open to opportunistic infections. Again, showing that just depleting one nutrient over three generations, that the phenotype of the immune defense of the animals continually declined, so that the third generation she produced immune compromised animals that then took three more generations of zinc repletion to build them back to the original state. Now recall, if you would, we're not talking about changing the genes. We're talking about the expression of the genes in the phenotype that are modified by exposure. So this is not Lysenkoism. I'm not talking about the adaptation of the gene as a consequence of altering the environment that Lysenko, the Russian physiologist, talked about geneticists. I'm rather talking about the phenotypic change. Well, that concludes the first half of this history from this last decade and last century. Let's move to side two and talk about the present and where it's taking us to the future. Welcome back to side two of our Millennium Edition of Functional Medicine Update. We've been talking about the historical contributors that have taken us to this extraordinary threshold of the new millennium in health sciences and how this new healthcare system is going to have a paradigm shift that will be comparable to that of any we've seen in the history of humans. Let me finish up with some names. I've just finished with Dr. Bob Pottinger and Dr. Weston Price. Of course, we would have to put into the same historical record Dr. Benjamin Feingold, who during the same period of the 50s and 60s and 70s made the observation about diet and hyperactivity that then was the foundation and basis of the Feingold movement, the low food coloring, food additive, low salicylate diets for children that have hyperactivity. This was really considered so controversial because during the 50s, through the development of the supermarket and shelf-stable foods and foods that tasted very sweet and had all sorts of colors and synthetic flavors, kids were being raised on these for the first time in the United States. It was an experiment, actually, for which we had no precedence in the history of the human species. And Feingold had the audacity to say, hey, some of these food materials, these ingredients, may be producing neurochemical changes in these children that have genetic susceptibilities and producing behavior disorders. And boy, did that create a groundswell of antagonistic response to individuals who had vested interest in the status quo. It's interesting to note that over the last 30 or 40 years now, the Feingold hypothesis, as we've learned more about brain biochemistry and NMDA receptor sites and glutamate sensitivities and neuroexocytotoxicity, we're starting to see that, lo and behold, there are these genetic variants that can respond to some of these substances that we're slipping into our diet in higher quantities, like butter yellow and other chemical agents, that could induce these functional changes, not to mention glutamate through MSG, monosodium glutamate, having a potential effect. So I think we would certainly put Ben Feingold on that list of extraordinary contributors. We might even put Dr. Denham Harmon, a professor of medicine at the University of Nebraska School of Medicine in the 1950s. He published a paper which now, looking back, may have been one of the classics on the role of free radicals in aging. It went on to show how vitamin E could help to prevent free radical damage in animal systems. And I guess we would have to call him the father of the free radical theory of aging and oxidant stress-related aging. Denham Harmon, MD, PhD, who actually had been a student of Dr. Pauling, interestingly enough, in his undergraduate days and getting his MD, PhD later at Berkeley, was really the father of this concept of free radical aging. And then Dr. Henry Beeler, working with a group of colleagues in Southern California who were health advocates, in which he wrote the book called Food is Your Best Medicine, talking about how food contains constituents that help to promote function, still fairly relative to where we are today, unsophisticated in its understanding of the constituents that could promote health, but making the observation that there was something about whole foods that could, in fact, promote health and could actually treat certain kinds of diseases when it was used appropriately. And then Dr. Evan Shute, as you know, the work that he did, cardiologist at London, Ontario, Canada, who stepped out of his discipline and created incredible backlash against him that almost had him defrocked as a cardiologist because he had the audacity to purport that this vegetable concentrate that was introduced to him by a friend at the University of California, Berkeley, who had discovered the substance to give birth in rats, to tocopherol, to give birth, from the Greeks to give birth, that is vitamin E, and said that maybe this vitamin E could be useful in treatment of certain kinds of cardiovascular problems. So sharing that in the 50s and 60s with Dr. Shute resulted in Dr. Shute making observation in his own patients with burns and with wounds and with cardiac problems of improvement. And what an incredible clinical investigator. He, as you know, published a report for over 30 years demonstrating, he and his brother Wilford, that vitamin E has a very, very profound effect on healing and recovery and the prevention of scarring. And again, where did that get picked up? It did not get picked up in medicine, unfortunately. It got picked up by the health food industry. And therefore, it was then considered reputable information, because if it was really authentic information, it wouldn't end up in medicine and it wouldn't have ended up in the health food industry. But yet we've seen over the last 30 years the vitamin E story weave its way beautifully through science to where now suddenly it's been discovered by medicine, and epidemiological studies are published and intervention trials are published in which they're showing that, yes, those people who consume higher than the RDA doses of vitamin E are individuals that have lower cardiovascular disease risk, lower cancer disease risk, and that there is something about its ability to serve as a gene response messenger and control of redox potential within cells that is very important for the overall function of the cell, the tissue, or the organ. And the doses of vitamin E that were suggested by the RDA may not be adequate to meet the needs for optimal function in a population that expects to live 7, 8, or 9 decades without disease. Why? How did the RDAs for vitamin E get established? Well, you might be surprised to learn they were established by the following mechanism. It was assumed by the Food and Nutrition Board that because vitamin E deficiency did not have any acute disease associated with it, like vitamin C deficiency does with scurvy, that those individuals who are assumed to be apparently healthy must be getting adequate vitamin E in their diet. Therefore, by evaluating what the common vitamin E intake was in this country in the 50s and 60s, which was about 15 to 30 IUs per day, it was assumed that must be adequate, and that was what the RDA was established around. One obviously would ask the question from this, how does that relate to function of vitamin E and promotion of physiological reserve? And that's a whole different question that only within the last 20 years, as we move into the new millennium, have there been serious steps made in understanding function of these nutrients, and particularly vitamin E. When we talk vitamin E, we certainly have to also give attribution to Dr. Max Horowitz, a principal investigator at the medical school at St. Louis University Medical School, and who made some extraordinary observations on the importance of increasing vitamin E intake as our polyunsaturated fatty acid intake increases in our culture, because vitamin E is necessary for helping to protect vitamin E from oxidative damage. And so if we strip out vitamin E from our diet and increase vegetable oil consumption, which was a trend in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that we may be creating more risk to oxidative injury. And then there's Dr. A.L. Tappell at University of California, Davis, one of the first people to really look at the role that antioxidants have in the prevention of oxidative stress within cells, as seen as lipofuscin bodies or ceroid pigment that is deposited within the nervous system, and how antioxidants could at the biochemical level influence then these clinkers, these damaged debris that are formed during oxidative stress reactions. So opening up again the free radical theory of aging and age-related diseases that was initiated by Dr. Denham Harmon. And then, of course, around food and the food's communication to the body, how food has information in it, and it can communicate this information to the body. I'm now speaking to Theron Randolph's work, extraordinary discoverer in the ecology of food, and how differing foods and individual genotypes can produce untoward effects. The food of one may be the poison of another. A very powerful concept when we start thinking about not just what is considered a good diet. Wheat and dairy might be considered good in some people, and many other people it may produce an untoward message in that information of the food, relate to alpha-gliadin in wheat or the casomorphins found in dairy protein that create then an adverse physiological response. So we had the whole field of ecological medicine and environmental medicine born out of the observations of Dr. Randolph, and then how do we use food elimination diets to properly manage these individuals. And let's not just focus strictly on the scientists and the medical people of this era. We have to also look at some of the general public that raised our awareness. People like Jack LaLanne. A lot of people, I think, dismiss the contribution that Jack LaLanne made. I recall back as a child that he was on the first television stations doing his exercise and talking about nutrition and talking about yeast and talking about liver. This seemed so strange to the average person, and the medical community at the time would just really ridicule and point fingers at Jack LaLanne. But, you know, as you look at him now in his 80s, he's a pretty fit guy. A lot of people that were his critics aren't around to even criticize anymore. They've become morbidity and mortality statistics. So there was something about Lalaine, both as a spokesperson and as a devotee and as a committed individual, that got our attention. Of course, Adele Davis. How can we forget Adele Davis and her books? It really created the groundswell of what has now become, really, the resurgence of medical nutrition in nutritional pharmacology. Certainly, much of what is in Adele Davis's books today doesn't stand the test of scrutiny, but there was a theme that really was extraordinarily important to get us to understand the role that nutrients play in promoting physiological function. Paul Bragg, another one of those individuals whose name I think lives on as a fundamental contributor to this field, whose exercise and nutrition commitments to health helped us to better lead the way with things like low-fat, high-complex carbohydrate, unrefined diets for cardiovascular disease and for diabetes, the Pritikin revolution that we'll talk about later. Then looking at Carlton Fredericks, who I think anyone who has been in this field for 20 or more years would see that Dr. Fredericks, who may himself not have elected the perfect lifestyle, but as a educator, as a communicator, as a guide, as a person who really stood as a model for so many people to think about nutrition and health, certainly would go down as an individual. I think Low Blood Sugar and You, one of his books, one of his many books, is a classic. He was one of the first people to really talk about the higher protein, lower carbohydrate diet for normalizing insulin through the blood sugar connection that was called hypoglycemia, reactive hypoglycemia. So again, I think Carlton Fredericks, an educator par excellence, helped us to get to where we are. And then Nathan Pritikin, which I mentioned. Where did Mr. Pritikin come from? You know, he was a brilliant man, an electrical engineer, who himself in his early 40s had serious health problems and was not slated to live much longer, and sought out the care of a physician he had been told about that was doing extraordinary work at the University of California, Los Angeles, Dr. Lester Morrison, a cardiovascular researcher who had developed a dietary program and lifestyle that was called the high complex carbohydrate, low fat, modest protein, high fiber dietary approach. He was a real heretic, this Lester Morrison. He was a strange person. I mean, cardiologists didn't talk about dietary intervention using this very unusual fat restriction approach. But Pritikin went to the Morrison Clinic at UCLA, went into that program with great commitment, and lo and behold, his health was rescued, and the rest is history. From that, because Pritikin was such a marvelous communicator and synthesizer of information, he took that concept to a much higher level of understanding and really created a major groundswell of shift in our paradigm within medicine, even though the medical community resisted it for many years. You can see it weaving its way very strongly into the foods and the recommendations of the American Heart Association, the American Diabetic Association. Nathan Pritikin, Lester Morrison, and then later, how about the exercise component? We have to give attribution to Dr. Kenneth Cooper, the father of the word aerobics, during the same period, who got us to recognize how, in fact, sports medicine and the activity levels of even a simple walking program could have such remarkable effects through the transduction of these messages of exercise into the gene expression of function. Just like Celier did with stress, he made aerobics a common parlance of understanding and discussion. It built a whole new industry, the industry of fitness, the industry of vitality, the industry that our heart and our vasculature, our immune system, our nervous system, our immune system are dependent in part on our activity patterns. And then we saw Covert Bailey come along and do a wonderful job of helping us to understand how exercise relates to body composition through the fitter fat approach, that you could be a thin fat person, that your body percent fat could be high even if you're looked reasonably thin because you've been on repetitive restriction diets with no exercise and you've been eating up muscle and replacing it with body fat. And that whole concept of body composition and fitness, the relationship it had not just to heart function, but overall body function. And then, of course, Richard Passwater, Dr. Dick Passwater, and his extraordinary contributions in the marvelous books that he published starting in the 70s that helped us to understand the next level of science from that of Adele Davis and how vitamins and minerals could be used therapeutically to promote function. I think Dick Passwater would also go down in the annals of being one of the first people within the health food industry that really raised the level of science, raised the bar, and got us to think more about mechanisms and requiring studies to be done and more science to really underpin claims and understand at a fundamental level of truth the mechanism as to how these nutrients work. Then we go to the 1980 period. Now we're more moving into the present, 1980 to the turn of the century. Dr. James Freese, professor of medicine, Department of Preventive Medicine at Stanford University, in his landmark paper on aging, natural death, and the compression of morbidity. the concept that we could have organ reserve and we could promote organ reserve by practicing the right things, and that that reserve could be worked upon and used as we needed it throughout our aging process to lower biological age, a very powerful and different concept than you are well until proven sick. It was a 1998 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine where Dr. Fries came back with a 17-year follow-up study demonstrating that, lo and behold, those people that did elect to maintain a proper body weight to height ratio and have regular exercise and not to smoke did, in fact, not only live longer but lived healthier, that they compressed morbidity into but a short period of their life at the end. They didn't just live longer with more sickness. They lived longer without sickness. So it's a very profound concept of taking charge of one's genes, the locus of control. Derek Lonsdale, again, 1980, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and his colleague Raymond Schamberger from the Cleveland Clinic, who reported that children who have low transketolase activities suggesting inadequacy of vitamin B1 had behavioral problems and learning disabilities, and that even though they were consuming what were considered the RDA levels of vitamin B1, that they had lower metabolic functions of B1. They had subclinical beriberi, so to speak, that affected brain function. And by increasing then their B vitamin intake to that greater than the RDA, that their clinical function improved and their biochemical indices of B complex adequacy, intracellular adequacy improved. A very different thought about how to measure nutrient needs based upon functional testing rather than just on serum levels. And, of course, then we had Dr. Richard Pryor at the University of Louisiana helping us to understand free radical aging and its relationship to nutrients. And the term then oxidative stress was really born out of Helmut Sees' work in Germany. The combination of Dr. Pryor and Dr. Sees has exploded a new chapter in the field of medicine, which is oxidative stress and antioxidants and redox control and intercellular signaling and cell messaging, signal transduction, NF-kappa B, AP1, I mean, all these terms that are now emerging have come out of this period in the 80s in which Dr. Pryor actually authored a paper that appeared in Scientific American showing the same strain of rats that had been of the same age, born in the same litter, one of whom was exposed to oxidants in the form of ozone and had no increased antioxidants, and the other that was exposed to the same level of ozone but had high levels of antioxidants, showing that the one group of animals under oxidative stress with no antioxidants just looked ragged and worn out in age, and their fur was coming out. They looked like senescent rats. And their litter mates under the antioxidant regime, under oxidant stress, had what appeared to be very much younger looking physiognomy. So again, helping us to put a molecular medicine explanation under some observations. Of course, Irvin Fridovich and Chuck McCord during the same period, two primary investigators at Duke and Stanford respectively, discovered superoxide as a agent produced in cellular physiology and the enzyme superoxide dismutase that is there to suck it up before it creates damage, and then how that relates to the Fenton reaction, the iron catalyzed reaction where superoxide is converted to hydroxyl radical, and how antioxidants play a role in prevention of this free radical pathology. All of this theme is starting to emerge during the 80s and 90s. And then Ed Schneider, the Deputy Director of the National Institutes on Aging, MD, PhD, what does Dr. Schneider tell us in his landmark paper in the New England Journal of Medicine entitled RDAs of the Elderly? He points out that the recommended dietary allowance levels probably don't meet the needs for nutrients to promote proper healthy aging because there are specific needs for biochemical function in aged individuals that are not met by the RDAs. Again, slowly but progressively chipping away at the fundamental paradigm of the RDAs as a mantra for good nutrition, and that the diet of moderation and variety from the foods of commerce, the so-called standard American diet, SAD or SAD diet, is a diet that will create adequate or optimal function. And then, of course, Dr. Erwin Rosenberg. I think he deserves tremendous attribution at Tufts University Medical School in Boston and one of the founders of the Human Nutrition Center on Aging, the editor and founder of the journal Nutrition Reviews that really started me thinking back in the 70s about how these things fit together in a scientific perspective. And, of course, the work that's being done now at the Human Nutrition Center on Aging with all of its other new investigators is at the forefront of understanding how nutrition can influence then the aging process, the biological aging process. And during the period of the early 80s, of course, that was the era of the discovery of AIDS, and the whole immune system came onto the radar screen with tremendous frequency. And investigator Dr. Rajit Chandra, one of the primary people in nutrition and immunity, helped us to better understand how it was that the nutrition could influence the immune system. And then Dr. Beisel authored a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association in which he talked about single nutrient effects upon immunological function that really raised the bar in medicine to see the implications of nutrition and fatty acids and minerals and vitamins on various immunological parameters, indicating it was more than just protein-calorie malnutrition that could relate then to inactive immune systems or altered immune systems. And, of course, what about Dr. Norman Shealy? I mean, if there's any individual that helped very significantly for doctors to get together to discuss areas of integrative medicine, it was Dr. Shealy, a neurologist, a pain specialist, who, by his own experiences, felt that there was more to managing pain than just uncoupling the message, which would be the pain analgesic and narcotic medications. He founded the American Holistic Medical Association back in the late 70s, early 80s, and really provided a place for physicians who had these thoughts to get together and talk responsibly about how to form a more complete healing system, an integrated healing system. And of course, that led to a whole generation of extraordinary doctors in the 1970s and 80s who have now reformed how medicine can be practiced from this integrative medicine perspective, many of whom have been on previous issues going over the last 18 years of Metabolic Update, Preventive Medicine Update, and more recently, Functional Medicine Update. I'm thinking of Dr. Jonathan Wright, coming out of Group Health in Seattle as a young physician who knew there was more than just treating crisis illness and started utilizing the principles of medical nutrition and molecular medicine very effectively in his practice, and with the many young investigators and young clinicians that came through his clinic in Washington State and Kent, such as Dr. Alan Gaby, who started to become experts in the field of nutritional medicine. And I want to give a moment of attribution to one of my intellectual forefathers, and that's Dr. Leo Bowles, who was still practicing almost full-time in Bellevue, Washington, and Washington State in his 80s. One of the first nutritionally focused doctors in Washington State, under tremendous scrutiny on the part of the medical advisory and medical licensure boards for over 25 years because he chose to march to a different drummer, but who always, with his patients, had the highest level of integrity and was really focused on healing and fearlessness about what he knew was right. And it's those people, those kinds of individuals, from which this medicine that we're seeing in the 21st century was born. Dr. Richard Cunyon, another physician, started the Orthomolecular Medical Association and brought together scholars and clinicians that were the Linus Pauling devotees in San Francisco, started this whole field moving very, very nicely through a different paradigm, a paradigm of molecular medicine applied to chronic health and disease problems. Dr. Gary Gordon, another person who I think deserves comment. Gary, going back into the 70s, a student of Harry Alsleben around chelation therapy, who later then started looking at minerals and the relationship of nutrition, and was a tremendous contributor to ideas and starting the academy that was focused on looking at chelation therapy, and most recently called the American College of Advancement of Medicine, which really provided an underpinning of quality education for individuals in this field and bringing in investigators from many different disciplines. And during this period, of course, we had the International Association of Preventive Medicine in the 70s and 80s, which again was a place where doctors could meet to start to study these concepts in greater applications in their practice. And Warren Levin, I think another New York physician who deserves tremendous recognition for being a pioneer and standing tall in providing a model to his patients and to other doctors about how these concepts could be applied significantly. Dr. Sidney Baker, ex-Yale Medical School professor and the most recent recipient of the Functional Medicine Linus Pauling Award in 1999, Dr. Baker doing an extraordinary job in helping us to understand how physiological function interrelates with personal experience in the environment and the inside-outside communication, and came up with the tax rule, which I think is a very interesting way of looking at the body, says that if you're sitting on two tacks and you remove one of them, you don't have 50% reduction in your pain. And his concept was, if you therefore only treat one part of a person's problem and you don't look at the underlying cause, which is that you got more than one tack sticking in your posterity, that you're likely not to get as full response as looking at the overall system. So his concept of the tacks rule, that you've got to remove all the tacks by looking at the underlying principle. Maybe the chairs you're sitting on have tacks on them and you shouldn't be sitting there to begin with. Dr. Baker has helped us tremendously to understand both the science and reasonableness of what he calls good medicine. And then, of course, Dr. Leo Gallen, Einstein-trained physician internist, who is a brilliant synthesizer of information and draws from the history and tradition of good science-based medicine, but has brought it into our better understanding in this field of nutrition and integrative medicine. His view of dysbiosis and being the person who coined that term, and gut parasitology in a time where we were told the Western world didn't have parasite problems, and he said, no, that's not true. And of course, you don't see what you don't look for. And as people then started looking for parasites, lo and behold, they found them. And now we find in all sorts of articles difficulties with Giardia and Cryptosporidium and many other, Amoeba histolytica, Coccidioidomycosis, species, all of these various organisms that are producing different kinds of parasitic infections, which Dr. Gallen helped us to understand. And then I'll go back to my experience in the 70s, a clinician who really very strongly emerged around the pollen concept, Dr. Robert Cathcart, again, a person that we have had as a clinician of the month on Functional Medicine Update over the years, who was a very renowned orthopedic surgeon and actually had developed some of the prosthetic devices used for orthopedic surgery and was known within that field as an innovator and a leader, who was so convinced of the Pauling hypothesis and concepts around vitamin C, started administering what he called bowel tolerance doses of vitamin C and showing that he could get remission of hepatitis and other viral infections because ascorbyl radical at high doses of vitamin C intake could be a very important virucidal agent. And he started to look at this clinically, and it was through the Cathcart work, a very, very good observer and a good doctor, that it was able to be demonstrated that vitamin C had effects at different doses, just as does aspirin. You might consider aspirin as baby aspirin to prevent colon cancer or heart disease, or as two aspirins taken for headache, or multiple aspirins taken throughout the day for arthritis. Different physiological effects at different levels, and I think that's what Dr. Cathcart helped us to understand with regard to vitamin C. Of course, Dr. Donald Rudin, a psychiatrist, and you would say, well, what would a psychiatrist have to say about nutritional medicine? But he had so much to tell us back in the 70s in terms of understanding essential fatty acids. His work on omega-3 fats was absolutely at the forefront of our education, as he really presented to a group of physicians in the East Coast during his lectures in the 70s. He opened up a whole new field of how fats were not just bad, but there were friendly fats, or what we call essential fatty acids, that could modulate physiological function and could even influence brain biochemical function. Now, you might consider that to be a big step. I mean, how could fats influence the brain? But as he pointed out, much of the architecture of the brain is made up of phospholipids that have essential fatty acids like DHA, docosahexaenoic acid, at the 2 position of the phospholipids, for whom these are essential fats that must be gotten in the diet. In a diet moving towards more warm weather plant oils and partially hydrogenated vegetable oils and saturated animal fats, that there may be a temporal insufficiency or even deficiency. And of course, it's more recently that we found through clinical trials that the insufficiency of these omega-3 fats may associate themselves with ADHD, associated attention disorder, hyperactivity disorder in children, particularly in boys, who then have bedwetting and thirst and skin problems that are all manifestations of essential fatty acid insufficiencies. Again, we owe Dr. Horobin for this extraordinary contribution to opening up this field. And what about Dr. David Horobin? Not only Don Rudin, but David Horobin, a physician, experimentalist, a synthesizer, a very creative individual within the whole field of medicine, coming from a pharmacological model, transitioning it through his own experience into nutritional medicine, through his understanding of the role that gamma-linolenic acid, GLA, a desaturated, chain-elongated derivative of linoleic acid, the omega-6 essential fatty acid, the 18, two double bonds, so it would be 18:2 omega-6 fatty acid. And Dr. Horobin really helped us to understand gamma-linolenic acid and its relationship to promotion of the 1-series eicosanoids, the PGE1 family, which are antiplatelet adhesive, anti-inflammatory, and anti-cell proliferative. And it's the balance, he pointed out, between the 1 and 2 series eicosanoids that can determine things like inflammatory or cell replicative or platelet adhesive effects. So the use of GLA for things like multiple sclerosis and immunological problems of arthritis and even problems of schizophrenia were extraordinarily important. Then we go on from Dr. Horobin and Dr. Rudin into Dr. Bill Ray, who followed up beautifully from the themes of Theron Randolph in environmental and ecological medicine. Dr. Ray is a surgeon who, as you know from his Clinician of the Month interviews in Functional Medicine Update over the years, has talked so knowledgeably as a visiting professor now in environmental medicine in England around the effects of detoxification and environmental sensitivities and a polluted environment that influences the yellow canaries of our world, the individuals with detoxification defects in their cytochrome P450 and conjugase enzyme systems, to have activities in their nervous and immune systems that would be considered atypical and therefore have been overlooked in medicine. And he has spent the last 2 decades plus of his life better understanding and writing a 3-volume series on environmental medicine, thousands of references that really define beautifully the implications and origin of this field. This is a tremendous recognition of how different biochemical archetypes, the biochemical individuality of Williams and the genetotrophic disease concept and the orthomolecular medicine of Dr. Pauling, weaves its way into the interrelationship of the patient to their environment. and how lifestyle and diet can modify these risk factors to an imperfect environment, an environment where there are literally tens of thousands of different chemicals outside us that are impacting our nervous and immune systems, for which then resistance to them is dependent upon our own detox systems. Dr. Jean Monroe, a physician in England who has helped to spread and to propagate this information of environmental medicine, her work in England, which looks at detox enzyme profiles and has collaborated with Glenn Steventon at Birmingham University Medical School, a neurologist, has helped us to better understand how to modify and modulate the detox pathways of individuals. And that has led to the birthing, in part, of this whole field of pharmacogenetics, as you know, a new field within pharmacy, in which it's now recognized that different people have different responses to medications that is dependent upon their own detoxification uniquenesses. Isn't that a really tremendous new breakthrough in medicine, in which atypical adverse drug reactions may not be atypical at all, but rather reproducible if we ask a different question about the person's detoxification machinery? If they don't detoxify a specific drug, or they have an antagonism of that drug with something else that vies for the same detox pathway, the therapeutic dose of that drug, which may be considered okay in one patient, may produce supraphysiological levels in another and an adverse response due to the buildup of intermediary molecules, so-called biotransformed intermediates, that can be more toxic than the drug that we started off with. And it's that recognition that is now requiring drug companies to start to do pharmacogenetic testing to know whether that drug is metabolized by cytochrome P450, 2D6, or 1E2, or 1A1. These are themes that we have been talking about in Functional Medicine Update now for a decade, since 1990. This has been a major part of our discussion, which is only now becoming part of the paradigm in medicine as we move into the new millennium. And then, of course, we ask, how does natural medicine get woven into this fabric? How is it going to play a role in the equation of healthcare delivery in the new millennium? And in order to answer that, we really need to go back, I think, to people like John Bastier, Dr. John Bastier, who in the Washington State area was such a guide, a sage, a leader, that he was able to have a group of very intelligent and highly capable, dedicated people group around him for training on the tenets of naturopathic or natural medicine. From Dr. Bastier's teaching, Dr. Joseph Pizzorno, one of his students back in the 70s, and Dr. Les Griffith and Dr. William Mitchell collected together to start a college in natural medicine under his name, the Bastier University. It became the first accredited college in the United States in natural medicine and is now turning out extraordinarily competent and capable naturopathic physicians that are seeding the whole of the country. That, along with the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland and the Toronto College of Naturopathic Medicine in Canada, and now the Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine in Arizona, are starting to emerge a quality of graduate that is integrating natural medical therapies within the field. We're seeing several new colleges that are now coming up to better provide for naturopathic medical education, including the New England College of Naturopathy. And in fact, in more states are naturopathic physicians who are grounded in the concept of natural medicine based upon the science of proper anatomy and physiology being educated and accredited to provide these services in an integrative medical system, a distributive medical system, one in which outcome-based medicine will become the watchword, in which no one person can know it all, but interacting one with another discipline can produce a better system, a web-like medical system. And then lastly, in international areas, people that have affected the thinking in their own countries, Dr. Robert Buist in Australia, as both chiropractor and a PhD in nutrition biochemistry, who has been an excellent educator and communicator over the last 20 years to the Australian medical and pharmacy communities about the role of natural and nutritional medicine, and Dr. Stephen Davies, the founder of the British Association of Nutritional Medicine, who has been a primary researcher and clinician and text writer in the field of nutritional medicine. The list goes on and on and on, but what is emerging from all of this is the recognition that the present has produced, then, as we move into the new millennium, an extraordinary opportunity for a paradigm shift, as Thomas Kuhn talked about it in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. We are at the threshold of a paradigm shift that is drawing from this rich tradition of the last 100 years of these investigators and clinicians and communicators, educators' comments and contributions to this changing thought pattern about the origin of disease and its remediation. Where will this field go? Will it be taking us into an era of gene splicing and genetic engineering? Or will it be taking us to an era in which we better are able to manipulate the genetic capability of the individual by optimizing their function in the phenotype? Is Dolly and the cloning of white-faced sheep the future of where medicine is going? Or is it that within our genetic polymorphic capability and pleomorphic capability as a human population, we have tremendous adaptability that we just have to promote the proper function from that variegated set of opportunities that exist within our genes? The deterministic model of Gregor Mendel, which was passed to us from the 19th century, tends to tell us that our genes are what they are, and they are static and determined and rigid and locked in place, and therefore our disease patterns are a consequence of flawed genes for which medicine is there to save us from our genes. That model is dying as we move into the new millennium. The model is that our genes are definitely there, but they represent the potential for function. There are many we's locked into our genes. The ones that are expressed are the consequence of the experiences of our living, starting from the moment of conception until the moment we stand there right now, those experiences washing over the genes to give rise to the upregulation of certain functions, the downregulation of others, and the expression of what we are at that moment. We are therefore, as I've said so often, the result of an unblinded, non-crossover, non-controlled experiment called our life. And if we don't like the results of that experiment, if the outcome is not good, then change the experiment, says this new paradigm. Find the right way of matching the communication of your lifestyle and your environment to resonate with your genes to give rise to the energy of function that improves outcome. That is the new paradigm. That is what Bishop and Waldhaus talked about in their landmark book called Genome, which was published in 1993, which they say it is not unmasking the genes in and of themselves that will determine the ultimate outcome to that patient, but rather it is the recognition that those genes are plunged into a harmful environment based upon that own individual uniqueness, that the expression of the gene that then causes the poor processing of cholesterol may then at that point exhibit heart disease. That quote is a very important quote that defines the future of where we're heading in the new millennium. It is the modification of our function throughout all of the work of these previous investigators and thousands that I didn't have an opportunity to mention on this tape that have created this threshold that we're now moving across. It's quite ironic to me that we have this arbitrary date in geological time called the year 2000. As we all recognize, there's nothing necessarily unique about that date in geological time, other than the fact that we have made it unique. We have called it as a culture a time of transformation. And it is moving to be just that, with the acceleration of what Toffler talked about now 15 years ago as a society in rapid change, in which the multiplication of knowledge and information occurs geometrically. This concept of moving into a Toffler-esque opportunity for change is creating then a major, major reworking of the view of how and why we get sick and what to do about it. I was really struck by the book Market-Driven Healthcare, authored by Regina Herzlinger, another person that we've interviewed on Functional Medicine Update as a professor of business at Harvard Business School, who told us that in the future, the next 10 years, healthcare will be framed not by the third-party reimbursers, but by the consumers of healthcare, and that the recognition of consumers that they control the healthcare system and their rising advocacy for improving their health will continue to work with the new developed science of how genes can be promoted to optimal function to create this new paradigm. And that the old models, although they might die hard because there's an inherent inertia that has to be overcome, they will die because truth has its own vector. It will out. Well, I think that we're in an interesting period in which we're living through that renaissance. I always wondered how it was back in what we call the renaissance in Europe, whether people knew that they were going to be reported on as being individuals that lived through this great period of human history, or did they just hear some different music and see some different art, and their architecture looked a little different, and the literature sounded different, but they never put it together that they were in this epic period of human history until some historian wrote about it 50 years later. It's hard to know, you know, whether you're in a period of great historical transformation. But I think by all evidence, if we look around, just even at the 18 years of metabolic update, preventive medicine update, and now functional medicine update, that we have to come to the conclusion that this is a true, remarkable shift in thinking about how, why, and what to do about illness. How people get sick, why they get sick, and what to do about illness. And it comes from the final recognition of the underlying mechanisms of some of the degenerative diseases that I was told 30 years ago in my schooling were of unknown origin. Now we know something about the origin of these diseases. We know that there are underlying fundamental processes that have to do with intracellular signaling problems, dysinsulinism, dysglycemia, oxidative stress, mitochondrial uncoupling, chronic inflammatory mediation by the upregulation of various components within the immunological system that trigger action at a distance that then alters physiological function, methylation defects as a consequence of inadequacies of B6, B12, folic acid, alterations in gut floral integrity with the gut-associated lymphoid tissue that creates immunological alterations and cell signaling to distant sites from the gut saying foreigners on board, and detox pattern irregularities that cause these imbalance in detox that produces these biotransformed intermediates. Witness, if you would, the article that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine 3 years ago, in which the authors reported in a urban county hospital the prevalence of acetaminophen toxicity. And when they report this particular series of cases, they go on to state that it's interesting that those who died from acetaminophen toxicity were more likely the individuals that did not take abuse doses and suicide. It was generally people that took lower doses but had uniquely poor detoxification patterns for acetaminophen because they had been fasting or consuming alcohol or in poor quality diets or had a unique genotype of altered detoxification of acetaminophen. Acetaminophen is detoxified by acetochrome P450 into an intermediary molecule called NAPQI, anapthoquinone. It's very hepatoneurotoxic. If that is not properly conjugated in the liver with glutathione, a form of mercapturate, then that intermediary compound can be very damaging to the liver and the brain. People that are on poor quality diets or consuming excess alcohol or individuals that are fasting are people who end up having depletion of the glutathione in the liver necessary for detoxifying that intermediate and therefore are multiple times more susceptible to toxicity. This is a new theme. It was only in the early 1970s that the first cytochrome P450 molecule was even discovered. We're talking about medicine that is only 25 to 30 years old from its fundamental first research understanding and from which a new paradigm in medicine around genes and environment is being born, the plasticity of gene expression, not the determinism of a Mendelian model of rigidity. I'd like to say that where we're going in the future and what you'll hear in Functional Medicine Update throughout 2000 moving into the 2001 and what you'll hear in functional medicine as it evolves through our applied functional medicine and clinical practice training programs that we offer in Gig Harbor and through our symposia that we offer every year and our individual training programs in applied nutritional biochemistry and cell physiology from a functional perspective, you're going to hear a very, very dominant theme of these modifiable factors by matching genes and environment. How do we take the antecedents that that patient has and create an environment so that their triggers do not produce the mediators associated with specific signs and symptoms of chronic illness? How do we maximize and rectangularize their survival, compressing morbidity and but to the very last portion of their life and extend both life expectancy and extend quality of life? That is the theme, and that is the raison d'etre for functional medicine. I think it's very noteworthy that as we move now into the new millennium, that is a small indication of the increasing understanding of this field of functional medicine. The Institute for Functional Medicine, the parent organization from which the Functional Medicine Update is produced, has just been granted by the American College of Continuing Medical Education Accreditation Category 1 accrediting ability. We now have the ability to provide Category 1 accreditation for our courses and our training systems. So I think that this is all part of this extraordinary transition and transformation we're seeing in our culture. The Symposium 2000 obviously is going to be a great celebration. In May of this year, we will be in Scottsdale, Arizona, talking about energy and medicine and bioenergetics from a functional perspective. And I think that you'll find to be with 600 of your colleagues and an extraordinary group of presenters will be one of those energizing experiences to continue to reinforce both the techniques and concepts and practices that underlie functional medicine as we move into this century. I urge you to be part of our symposium, our Year 2000 symposium. Those of you that have not gotten the brochure or the information and want more information about it, please don't hesitate to call us at 800-843-9660 to inquire about our Year 2000 symposium for the Institute for Functional Medicine. In closing, I'd like to just add a little parenthetical thought. I've had the privilege of over the last 18 years having the same colleague sitting by my side and doing this month by month, Mr. Jay Johnson, Jay and I have considered ourselves as having a position of high responsibility because we have the privilege of communicating this information every month and now to 27 countries around the world, to thousands of practitioners and health providers, which means we could potentially influence the thoughts and actions in millions of patient experiences over the last 18 years. And I think it's a continuity to the relationship that Jay and I have talked about and looked at and conjured up and mused about and reflected upon, that we have really both felt we have traveled an extraordinary journey in this last 18 years. We've known great people. We've seen great dedication. We've seen a principle that relates to the patient being number one, and truth, sometimes as uncomfortable as it is, being our watchword, and standing against sometimes what is considered to be a reasonable misunderstanding on the part of those that have other perspectives, just trying to stay there and resonating and reflecting the work of many very competent people and trying to do a good job in representing their contributions. I'm very proud as we move into the 21st century of the record. As I go to the aft of the ship, the stern of the ship, and look out at the back, I think those people that we've described this month in Functional Medicine Update are the kind of people you'd want to hang out with in the world. They're very competent, capable, dedicated people to trying to make this world a better place. And I really want to, in a small way, honor all those people, both those that we mentioned and the literally thousands that we didn't have the opportunity to mention that are often working in a small lab, doing their work, not fully understood, trying to connect that work together with others, trying to see patients under an imperfect world and do the best they can, sometimes not getting rewarded and proper honored, sometimes having to have all sorts of problems with their colleagues because they don't get well understood. That, to me, is what is creating the great positive change. It's the collected energy of all of those aspirants who are promoting, I think, a single and important endeavor, which is improving the health, function, vitality, and for youth, the opportunity to be fully functional. And it's with that I'd like to close our centennial millennium issue of Functional Medicine Update. Thanks so much.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.